Who's going to come up?
Porter is coming.
Suzanne's going to come up first.
Feller has hats on.
What's that?
He'll come up.
Says what? How resemble I remark?
We're going to call the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means to order. I apologize, we got going late today. The board session ran over, and then we had other things going on. I'm going to open the public hearing again on Senate Bill 5509. Today we're continuing over the Department of Corrections budget. For the record, we're going to start off with a presentation from Suzanne Porter, who's with the DAS Office of Economic Analysis, regarding the prison forecast. Thank you for coming.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Porter. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services. And I'm going to brief you on the corrections population forecast. And I just found out yesterday morning I was supposed to be here today, so I put all this together in a hurry, and I'm trying to get done in 20 minutes. So I want to start real briefly, go over the methodology, talk about some intake trends, go through our new forecast, and if time's permitted, I wanted to show you what happened with the April 2001 forecast that I sat here 2 years ago, and that went into developing the current biennial budget. The method we use is called the flow model, and on page 2 of my testimony, there's a schematic of it. It's one of the two standard ways that corrections and caseloads are forecast in the country. Just a bunch of spreadsheets that mimic the flow of offenders through the felony system from arrest to disposition to revocation, release, and so on. So if you look at that schematic, we start with arrest, conviction, and people can get one of three dispositions at that point. And we forecast all those three caseloads, probation, prison, local control, and down at the bottom also parole and post-prison. We forecast all those. If you go to probation, you could commit another crime or have a technical revocation, which puts you in prison or local control. The people in prison or local control will eventually, most of them, be released to prison supervision. That also then puts them in the risk pool to commit another crime or a technical revocation and go back to incarceration. So those are continual feedback loops. And that is how our model is actually put together. So if we forecast an increase of people going to prison, eventually that's going to wind up in an increase in people going to post-prison supervision. So it all links together. And for the arrest, we actually forecast the arrest rate by age group and crime type. And to do that, we've been using Uniform Crime Reports, Oregon Uniform Crime Reports arrest rate, arrest by age group, the annual report. So if that goes away for a long period of time, we're going to have to rework that part of our model. Over on page 4, intake trends. These are felony intake trends, and these are things that we've been dealing with in this forecast and the April 2001 forecast. The chart at the top there, the first column is prison sentences. Those are sentences of more than 12 months. The next column over is a local control type sentence, people that were sentenced to 12 months or fewer, and then probation, then they're totaled, and then the percent change on all those sentences. So in the last 2 years, there's been a 2% increase overall in those sentences, but the real story is the shift toward the prison sentences that have increased. A decrease in local control sentences and really not much change at all in probation. On the prison side, that increase in intakes is on the low end of the sentencing. People sentenced to 13 months, mostly repeat property offenders, some felony drunken drivers fall into that category. For local control, important point about that is that about 80% of the people that enter local control are revoked from community supervision with no new conviction. Half of them are revoked from probation. And over on the far corner are intakes to parole and post-prison supervision. You can see they've been increasing. And in the last couple of years, most of that increase is from people that are coming out of prison rather than local control. So there's a greater mix of people, of, you know, ex-cons and that, or, you know, people coming right out of prison. Part of that is, again, you've got growth in people with relatively short prison sentences, so some of them are already done and gone and on parole and post. And then you have your first batch of Measure 11 offenders that have completed their sentence and now are on post-prison supervision. So those are the trends that underlie the forecast. On page 5 is our April 2003 forecast, and that's starting out with the impact of House Bill 5100 from the last special session. The specific part of that we had to model was the cut to indigent defense. There's a lot of other things that Bill did, but we work with an advisory committee, and the membership of which is in the last page of your regular forecast document. In talking with our committee, nobody could really get a real clear handle on how some of those other cuts were going to affect the correction population, like the state police, the crime labs, closing the youth correctional facilities. But they could get a handle on the indigent defense cuts, so we did model that. And the assumptions are on page 5. I won't read them all to you. But I think the most important assumption we made was after July 1st, we assumed that the funding would come back for indigent defense. And in talking to our committee, talking to court administrators and the District Attorneys Association, at the time we were making this forecast, everybody really thought people would get creative and process those delayed cases between, say, August and the end of the year, on top of the regular caseload. If we didn't do that, if we just assumed that after July 1st we'd go back to kind of the level of February, that makes a really big difference in the forecast. So, you know, we assume that all these delayed cases, or a lot of them, were going to move through. So you keep that in mind.
Between August
and the end of
the end of this year.
Yeah.
Okay.
When Santa Claus comes, we'll leave that too.
And we made this forecast, I think we released it in the last week of March, so we had the people that we were talking to had, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of experience with the indigent defense cuts. So at the top of page 6...
Did you factor out failure, an increase in failure to appear rate or an FTA rate in those August through July?
Mr. Chair, the way we did that is we worked backwards from prison, probation.
We realize you're, this is new.
We did.
You're plowing new ground, so I'm just wondering how you did it.
Well, we worked backwards, and since there's always there's always failure to appear going on. There's always people out there absconded. So if we work backwards from when a person hits the door to corrections to when their first appearance was, I mean, now we're only looking at people that did show up. And there's a little bit of slippage built in for extra failure to appear. But because we're not starting with the court and moving forward, we're at the back end where all that failure to appear is already taken care of. So there's a little bit extra in it, but, you know, not a lot over what there are.
What percentage did you build in about? I mean, do you remember what your plug number is? Just my experience is there are probably going to be a much higher failure to appear rate. So, and I think in my conversations with DAs, they feel that there's going to be a substantially higher failure to appear rate, and so consequently, we won't get the convictions as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So, I want to know on your forecast basis what.
Yeah, I have to go back and look.
I mean, we're all kind of.
No,
we're all kind of testing for elevation and windage on this thing.
What we did is pulled, I think, 250 cases that, you know, people that have already entered prison, probation, and so on, the types of cases that would be affected. And we researched each one of them individually in OGIN to see when their What was the elapsed time between their first appearance in court and when they entered the system? And so some of those people had, you know, 2 years because they absconded. So any of that kind of absconding, that's built in. And that's a little extra than what we would normally have. But no, we didn't, because we had no idea. I heard that, you know, that there's going to be more absconding, but there's already absconding built in, and we just didn't have any idea other than, you know, a dartboard of how much more there was going to be.
So you don't have a factor built in. You have a little bit of a factor built in.
It's just, yeah, based the percentage that appeared in those test cases, and I could go back and get it to you.
I'd be interested to know what percentage you increased for your abscond rate, so I have an idea.
Okay.
So I have an idea as we look at the tight numbers in funding that.
Okay.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking for any external factors that might influence the forecast, wondering if there's any possibility that the OSP staff reductions that began earlier this past year may have some serious adverse effect in actual forecasting of the numbers.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, our committee, you know, felt that a lot of those cuts are going to have some kind of effect, but they really, beyond conjecture, they really didn't have a handle on it. There are some things that are a drag on the system, and some things that put more people into the system. You have fewer arrests. You have a backlog in the crime lab. That's a drag. Then on the other hand, you have some 17 and 18-year-olds that just got released from the youth authority. That can cause an increase. Let's see. Oh, you have repeat property offenders that don't have defense counsel and are going around for 4 months, you know, probably doing more crimes. So there's a drag, you know.
I have a question regarding that while you're there, Suzanne. Do you have some feeling then that those August through December 2003 glut that will be coming forward will actually volunteer to be rearranged? I guess that's the word, rearranged or arraigned for the first time, so that they can be sent off to prison hard beds? Will people voluntarily come forward and say, oh, yes, do we have folks that will, when they come forward for their arraignment, that will actually move from the arraignment as a result of a conviction and then be sentenced to prison?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yeah, in researching the cases I looked at, I mean, people do that. I mean, they show up for their court appointment and get convicted and go to prison.
So we actually have people then that are awaiting this July arraignment so that we can have this arraignorama beginning in July, and that arraignorama will assist in fulfilling the forecast of the folks that are going to glut back into the prison doors. They'll really be lining up to go back to prison, voluntarily.
We're calling it the plea-orama.
Plea-orama, okay.
As opposed to the arraignorama.
All right.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, in that, you know, there is always absconding going on, and then there are always people that show up. Now, and there's usually about a 3 to 4 month lag between when you show up as a repeat property offender for your first hearing and when you finally get sentenced and go to prison. So, you know, whether it's 3 months or 7 months, there are some people that are going to show up and do that. And, you know, people are always absconding. How many more are going to abscond because it's extra amount of time? You know, I don't know, and nobody really knows for sure. So I used what this little test cases that I came up with, I used what that gave me, and that I'll supply with you later. But
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate your comment, particularly about the fact that this is some untested water here.
Ms. Porter, did you also, in looking at the forecasting, and now with a month's experience, basically, or 6 weeks of experience, what's it done to the current forecast? I mean, are we meeting the current forecast as a result of what's gone on with indigent defense and the courts, or has, or are we behind? Do we know? Is it too early to tell?
Mr.
Those
Chair,
items were already in the queue, so they probably don't have the effect right now. I just
for prison, we have data every day on what the prison population is, and the effect on prison is small and it's delayed. We really don't expect to see much effect until May and June.
Okay.
I suspect it's probably affecting probation and local control, but we don't see those numbers until 4 months after the fact.
That's fair to say, because the cases still have to go to trial, and they were probably appointed into defense counsel beforehand, and so I understand. I just wanted to ask if you had any recent experience.
Well, right now the prison population forecast is running anywhere from 30 to 50 beds lower than the actual population. And but we really wouldn't expect, as I recall, maybe the biggest effect comes up in June and July from the repeat property offender cases, because there's a 3-month lag and people that already have defense appointed are moving through the system. So the impact of House Bill 5100 on the major populations is at the top of page 6. And as I go through the forecast for those groups, I'll mention, you know, how it is that 5100 affects those. Starting with prison, we had 11,733 inmates in January 1st of this year, and we expect that to be 1.9% higher as of the end of this biennium. Over the next biennium, we expect 9% growth and then 7% growth in the next biennium after that. House Bill 5100 has a pretty small effect on the prison population, and it's mostly in repeat property offenders. Overall, the current forecast is higher than the last one due to that shift we've been seeing the last couple of years away from local control and probation toward prison sentences. On page 7 is community supervision, starting with probation. We had 18,300 probationers on the caseload as of October of 2002. We expect that to fall by 1% by the end of this biennium. Over the next biennium, we expect 3.9% growth, and then over the following biennium, 1.5% growth. 5100 has a pretty big effect on probation because most people that are convicted of Class C non-person felonies get a probation sentence. And if you look at the top of page 6, under the probation column, 5100 actually has a positive effect in the out years, and that's due to that assumption that a lot of these cases are going to get processed on top of regular work. Overall, the forecast is lower. We have the right amount of intakes forecast. It's the length of stay on probation has dropped. So we adjusted for that, and that makes our current forecast lower than the last one. Bottom of page 7 is parole and post-prison supervision. We had 11,160 on that caseload on October 1st of 2002. We expect 0.8% growth by the end of this biennium, 2.7% during the next biennium, and then 5.5% growth during the 05-07 biennium. And the effect of House Bill 5100 on parole and post is delayed over several years, and it's just, they go to prison and local control later than they would have in the absence of 5100. That means they get out later and they go to post-prison supervision later. So they all get there. They just get there later than they would have. Overall, the forecast is lower than the last one. And again, we had the right amount of intakes, but the length of time people are spending on the caseload went down, so we made that adjustment, and that's the reason for the change in the forecast. The local control forecast is on page 8. There were 1,617 people in local control on October 1st of 2002. We expect that to drop by a quarter by the end of this biennium, and then increase by 40% over the next biennium. So it's real fast down and up. And that effect is all 5,100. As I said, half the people that go to local control are due to a probation revocation. So if your crime was for other than a violent crime, you don't get indigent defense. Also, the length of time between the first appearance and when you go to local control for one of these revocations is usually within 30 days. So it has a fast effect. And then again, it recovers because of that assumption that these cases were going to get processed through in the fall. Page 9 shows the forecast, a little more detail over this in the next two biennia. The prison inmate forecast is built from a bunch of smaller forecasts that we add together, and that's on the top. And I just wanted to call your attention that the middle of the graph there where it says total female, that's the female inmate population, which we increase significantly this time. The population of female inmates went up by 26% during 2002, and we had a 44% increase in intakes. A lot of those are identity theft or theft, and it really has happened since the very late in 2001 and through 2002. So that's what's driving that increase in the female inmate population.
Primarily identity theft has created the...
Identity theft and theft and some drug.
Would generate a 25% increase in female. It wasn't just the fact that we had the space in it with the openings.
Representative Butler, that's one of my suspicions, but I can't get anybody to go along with that. But, to me it seems like it would be an attractive sentencing option, not, hey, let's send them there, but... if we don't have any other options and we have, a good facility to send people to that's doing good work with families. I mean, the increase in intakes is suspiciously, starts like right around the time that Coffee Creek opened.
That would be interesting to know those of the crimes that those women were sentenced to before the intake at Coffee Creek began. If those happen to be of the same nature of the increases, the 25% increases that we've got, are those theft and identity theft? The women that are presently already in custody?
Yep, females, those are the most popular crimes that they would go to prison for, is drugs or some kind of theft.
Okay. Well, if it doesn't modify the blend, then I guess it's probably justified if we've got that kind of crime being committed. I'm just surprised.
And some people... because identity theft started a couple years ago and you need one in your criminal history, that now with the timing, they've already got the one conviction, so when they come to the court again, they qualify for prison. So that's what I hear from prosecutors. And, it's not that there's a facility.
Sure.
Yes.
So the identity theft is more popular among women criminals than it is amongst male criminals?
As a percentage.
As a percentage?
Yeah.
I think it probably requires a little more smart to be an identity thief, and men don't possess that. Typical rule. Thank you. That's what my wife told me.
The risk to the forecast are
many. You
don't
wish to comment on that?
That's why they call me representative.
The risks to the forecasts are many, and I've been doing this forecast since October of 96, and I think right now I feel there's more uncertainty in the criminal justice system and of surrounding this forecast than even at the beginning of Measure 11. Now, one thing that we did is, as of July 1, we assumed the governor's first budget as the current policy because we had nothing else to go on, and we wanted to give people a firm idea of what we're basing it on, and I look at it as a starting point to where people could run what-if scenarios to deviate from that. One thing we did not do is the governor's budget reduced the community corrections funding level from an average population of 32,000 to 24,000. We didn't make any changes to the community corrections caseload based on that. We just went with current policy and practice. We have no idea if people are going to, you know, cut the number supervised or stretch the supervision, so we didn't deal with that in this forecast. And finally, I wanted to look back at the April 2001 forecast. How did that track over the biennium? And we measure accuracy first by average daily population during the biennium, and then another way to look at it is the population on a given day. So for prison, we have data through March 1st, 2003, and the average daily population of our forecast is 217 beds, or 1.9% lower than the actual ADP for that period. And as of March 1st, our forecast is 487 beds, or 4.1% lower than the actual population on that date. Now, we have never had this kind, we've never been low, and we've never had this kind of error. I went back and looked at the 9901 and the 9799 forecast. The 9901 forecast was 0.8% higher than the actual average daily population during the biennium, and the April 97 forecast it matched the actual ADP for that biennium. So this is new for us. For prison, the main reason that we're low: repeat property offenders, identity theft. We built growth into the forecast for identity theft. Thought it would grow by 8.5%. It grew by 57. The intakes grew by 57% in 2002 over 2000. So the repeat property offender population now is 275 beds higher than we thought it would be as of March 1st, 2003.
Question on the property offenders: because of the fact that a lot of the predicate offenses for property offenses are now being pled out in a lot of counties around the state, and that glut and the glut that's being offered, I think in Multnomah and Lane County and some of the other counties, some of the predicate repeat property offenses are being pled out, so they're not predicate offenses. Did we take that factor into account in the forecast to any degree as a variable?
Mr. Chair, we did not. I mean, no one mentioned that to us. Other than what's already, our forecast is based, this current one, is based on what's been going on for the last 6 months. So if that's not a brand new thing that just happened in the last month or so, it's built in.
Well, I guess my concern is we've had some of those predicate offenses fall off for the repeat property offender piece, because we're not appointing indigent defense counsel. Also, those things are being pled out. A lot of those items won't be resolved until the glut gets through, and the reason we get the repeat property offenders is because they just keep reoffending. So we won't have as many predicate offenses, I don't think. So I guess that's a concern. I mean, just talking off the top of my head, I don't know if that's a consideration, and you may want to. I'd appreciate if you at least think about that or float that.
Is that something that's just happening right now because of the indigent defense?
Yeah, it's happening because of the indigent defense, and all those cases are being, and a lot of those predicate offenses are being set over for the repeat property offense crimes. So a lot of those predicate offenses, which are the misdemeanor type cases, are being, you know, set off, and so therefore, you know, and you get these repeat property offender cases because they just continue to repeat, but you got to catch them the first time. So I'm just wondering if there's a drag or delay that's going to occur on the repeat property offender, if that makes sense. I mean,
yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? a little bit.
Yeah, there is. I mean, most of the effect on the prison population from 50 to 100 is in that group, in repeat property offenders.
Okay, so you have taken that into account.
Yeah. There's not a lot of growth built in for 2003. In 2004, we do have some growth, 7.5% growth expected because of forgery. Forgery 1 is going to start July 1st, 2003. We expect another bulge of people after that takes, after that goes into effect. Identity theft. For the last 2 years, we've undershot the repo forecast. We raise it up, you know, higher than we think it's crazy. We come back to do another forecast, and we're low. We've been playing catch up ever since April 2001. We would never have predicted a 57% increase in intakes over 2 years. I mean, people on our committee thought it was going to be big, but I don't think they thought it was going to be that big. Finally, for the April 2001 forecast for community corrections, combined probation and parole, the average daily population from our forecast is 1.2% higher than actual. However, the main source of data there was bad data. The data I had and the funded caseload included these felony cases that are actually misdemeanors. They're treated as misdemeanors that didn't get discovered until July of 2001. If I take those out and hold myself harmless for that, our forecast is 0.2% high so far through the biennium. Local control, our forecast is from April 2001, 11% higher average daily population than what actually occurred. That's where there's been a lot of change in local control. There's fewer people going into local control, especially from post-prison supervision, fewer people being revoked. And that change really started in mid-2001, where some counties decided to bring their populations down. And by then, our forecast was all set and over with. So I just wanted to give you, I guess, an idea of what happened last time when I sat here 2 years ago, and what went on with that forecast. And that's all I have. Any other questions?
Is there a, Mr. Chair, is there a figure, an exhibit number that we can see the effects of that forecasting with this change that's taken place? Is it in our handouts today somewhere? One of the exhibits or one of the graphs?
Of the felony to misdemeanor cases?
The types of offenses that, or the actual prison population that shows the forecasting versus the present actual.
From 2001?
Right,
from 2001 to 2003. I can
get that to you. We don't have a graph that shows that typically.
Nope, okay. But I could get that to you.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Other than, say, as to the types of crimes for which we're sentencing, is there something we've learned from the differences that are in there of the population? Suzanne, what are we learning from this, again, other than as the types of crime?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I brought it because with any forecasting, I think I read what, you know, it's like driving and looking in the rearview mirror. And as long as the road's straight, you're doing fine. And the road really turned on us and during this biennium. And I think right at the start of the biennium, some of the financial problems that the state and counties had just started to hit and changed people's practice of what they did. And so now, here we are 2 years later, now we really have uncertainty. And so that's why I brought it, just to show, you know, what can happen.
Mr. Chair, I assume, by way of clarification, if I may, when it changed people's practices, we're talking about the judicial system and sentencing. Is that right? Not in the way of crimes, criminals, corrupt crime activity, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yeah, the way that that cases were handled once they went in the system, rather than be revoked from post-prison supervision, we can sanction them for fewer days. That brings the jail population down. If you have someone that's in a grid block, I think there's one that goes from 11 to 13 months, you're probably going to get 13 months rather than 11, those kinds of things. And I think, as from what I heard from our committee, as local options went away and you're left with fewer and fewer options, and there is always a margin of people that could stay in the community or go to prison, and if there's no local options, then the tendency is to send them to prison.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm not understanding the criminal justice system as well as those who frequently are involved with it or practice by law, but those, I guess my concern is I'm really not understanding how, if it's the criminal justice system that's being tougher on the folks that they're being arraigned and coming before them after pleas or after a finding of guilt, or whether or not it's the criminal element. Any sense of that? I'm sorry, I don't have a better sense of it myself.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, there's it's a little of both, especially with repeat property offenders. Why did identity theft get made a crime and get added to that list? Because people were getting victimized by identity theft. So problems surface out there and we find a way to deal with it. So it's interrelated. But then on the other hand, sometimes it's just the criminal justice system. For example, a given county says, we can't afford this many jail beds. Let's bring them down. So instead of revoking people for 180 days, we'll do it for 120. Instead of revoking this group of people, we'll sanction them for 60 days. So something, there's still a consequence for the action, but it's a smaller consequence, and it frees up jail beds so that they can, reduce their budget.
Okay. All right.
Susan, I'm trying to get a good understanding of, you've obviously not being a deputy district attorney anymore, and you'd mentioned during your testimony kind of very briefly, but then I went to the ORS under 137, 717, which is the identity theft kind of statute. There are some additional sanctions that are going to go into effect that are delayed. I'm wondering if DOC can provide me the cost of those delayed sanctions as well as any other items that are not currently in force in law. It appears in just paging through the criminal code that oftentimes this legislature delays implementing things until into the future to avoid a fiscal impact. I'm interested to know what, if any, of those items that are projected to become law. I'd like a list of what those are, at least in terms of your consideration for your forecasting purposes, as well as the costs associated with those. While I appreciate the fact that I probably voted for many of those items during the last legislative session, as did probably everyone at this table, we now may be unable to sustain or do those. And rather than rolling back laws, we may be able to further delay them, which may be more palatable to the members of this body as opposed to driving the cost over the brink.
Well, you introduced about half of them.
Not these.
Mr. Chair, isn't it forgery one that's going to take effect?
Well, I don't know what all the lists. I haven't had time, but
I think
I'm seeing a lot of sections in the criminal code that say these laws become effective July 1, 2003. These laws become effective October 1, 2003. I'm seeing a lot of things, at least in the code right now.
Those are built into our forecast, and I can pull them out.
But what I'd like to do is get a list of statutes and maybe a real brief explanation of what you guys think they are, and then the costs associated with them, and then the date that they become effective, so that then we can take a look at those. And if you can get those to Doug, I'd also like to make sure that the indigent defense, that we send it over to Public Defense Services Commission to see where they're at in terms of making sure that they've factored all those items in, as well as any associated cost savings if those were factored in, as to our ability to delay those. I was not aware that there were as many cost drivers in the statutes potentially as there were, so your testimony has been helpful to at least perk up my ears and I think other members of the committee.
We can do that.
Mr. Chair, there's also a repeat identity theft bill sort of running through the system in the legislature now also, and that has a price tag of roughly $500,000, I believe, on it that is being voted on either in the House or Senate Judiciary.
And I think that will wind its way down to our committee ultimately, is the chair's hope.
Okay. And I have that, and then you wanted to know about absconding. I've got a note for that, so I can get this.
I appreciate that, and that will be definitely helpful. So, Ben, if you guys can work together to see the associated costs, and if there's any other cost. I mean, I think the main cost drivers are going to be corrections and indigent defense as to crimes that currently Senator Devlin couldn't be convicted of, but maybe after July 1, 2003.
He's clean as a houndstooth.
I just want to make sure he was awake and committed.
Other than for a save.
All right.
I'm done.
Thank you. Any further questions for the committee? All right. So, Ginger, you're going to come up.
Members of the committee, we're back to the notebook, presentation notebook, and there's a tab for community corrections in there.
I'm Ginger Martin with the Department of Corrections, Administrator for the Community Corrections Division, and I'm here to talk with you today about the budget for Community Corrections Administration and also Community Corrections Grant and Aid. Community corrections supervision and programs are provided directly by counties through intergovernmental agreement with the Department of Corrections. The Community Corrections Administration is part of the Director's Office and provides the funding for the management and supervision of over 30,000 felony offenders sentenced to probation, parole, or post-prison supervision, or to local control. On page 96 is a graph of all those three populations and the total. You can see that they are fairly stable populations. There's a small growth over the next biennium that Sue actually has reviewed already. There are three programs in community corrections. One is central administration, interstate compact, and community corrections grants and aid. Central administration is responsible for the statewide coordination and oversight of community corrections activities at the county level, including monitoring compliance with applicable laws and the administrative rules. The Interstate Compact Unit ensures Oregon's compliance with the laws governing the Interstate Compact for the transfer of supervision for adult offenders moving into or out of Oregon. And community corrections grant and aid is the funding that community corrections agencies receive as they employ a balance of supervision, correctional services, and community-based sanctions to manage the behavior of offenders while they're on supervision and to create long-term behavior change to reduce the risk that they might be engaged in future criminal conduct. The goals of community corrections are to reduce criminal behavior, to enforce court and board orders, to assist offenders to change in ways that reduce their future criminal behavior, and to provide reparation to crime victims through collection of restitution or community service. On page 98 and 99 is the organizational chart for Community Corrections Administration. There are no changes between this biennium and next. Let me give you a little bit more detail about each of the three program areas. Central Administration administers the state community corrections grants to counties. The office sets and monitors performance measures for county community corrections agencies. We have statutory responsibility to evaluate community corrections policy and to assess its effectiveness, to monitor the intergovernmental agreements between the state and the counties, and to provide technical assistance to counties in carrying out the functions of community corrections. We set guidelines for counties' community corrections plans, we write administrative rules, we develop the funding allocation formula, and we provide inspections for correctional facilities. The Interstate Compact Office processes applications for the transfer of offenders into and out of Oregon, and when offenders are transferring after release from prison to supervision in another state. There is a new Interstate Compact Agreement that has been enacted nationally, and so over the next few months, the rules for that new agreement will be enacted, and we'll need to train all of the folks out in the field offices so that we can remain in compliance with the new procedures. Community corrections grants and aid, again, is the funding that supports local community corrections activities directed at approximately 30,000 felony offenders supervised in the community. Activities include evaluating each offender's likelihood to commit new crimes, monitoring those offenders according to their behavior and their risk to reoffend, with greater emphasis being placed on those at greatest risk to reoffend. The community corrections agencies employ a continuum of effective community-based punishments, such as electronic home detention, work release, community work service, day reporting centers, and so on. Community corrections agencies offer programs which are designed to address the causes of criminal behavior and thus reduce the risk of a return to criminal activity. And they incarcerate offenders locally who previously served 12 months or less in a state prison, generally for a revocation due to a violation of conditions of supervision. On page 101, you'll see the summaries for administrative costs, interagency and intergovernmental programs, and cost control measures. Community Corrections Administration is an intergovernmental program. We work with the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Jail Managers Association, Association of Oregon Counties. We do work cooperatively with the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision so that we have consistent rules and procedures for all folks on community supervision so that post-prison matches probation as much as we can. And also, we've worked with the Department of Justice this last biennium to develop a statewide automated victim notification service. In terms of cost control, in 2001-03, Central Administrative Office was reduced by 50%. And the result of that is we have prioritized our activities so that they focus primarily on our statutory responsibilities as they are listed in the Community Corrections Act. As far as cost control in the grant and aid portion of the budget, the funding allocation is based on a capitated rate. Capitated rates encourage cost-effective systems, just as they do in the healthcare industry, and they encourage the careful use of the most expensive correctional interventions because you're getting an average rate per person. Some are going to cost less and some more. I'm going to spend a couple of minutes on the Community Corrections Budget Building Formula. That's on page 103. The Community Corrections Grant and Aid Budget is based on the corrections population forecast produced by Sue Porter and her office and on case rates established for various types of offenders based on actual costs and procedures. For the probation and post-prison group, the population is forecast according to their risk to reoffend. So we get a forecast for high-risk offenders, medium risk, low, limited, and for new cases. A separate forecast is done for interstate compact cases and for local control cases. Each of these seven categories has a corresponding case rate, which represents the average daily cost of managing an offender of that category. And you can see from the graph that about 40% of our population is high and medium risk to reoffend, about half are low and limited risk to reoffend, and the rest are split between interstate compact, new cases, and local control cases.
Ginger, what methodology do you use to determine high risk, medium risk, low risk, limited risk?
We have a risk assessment tool that's been validated a couple of times, and it asks questions about previous compliance, previous criminal history, alcohol and drug problems, the kind of things that are related to the high rates of reoffense. Property crimes, one of the specific crimes that appear on our assessment. And that's used for every offender in Oregon, so we have a standardized method of measuring risk county to county.
But those are factor-based testing?
Factor meaning?
Well, you've got the risk factor. You've identified the risk factors.
Correct.
But it's also modeled in data's, the data's proven out.
Yes, we tested it in the early 90s to make sure that it really was telling us which offender groups were the most likely to reoffend, and it did tell us that. Multnomah County just did a study last year, and they revalidated the risk tool. They were looking specifically at the low risk, but in doing that, they revalidated the risk tool. And what that means is it does, high-risk people really are the highest risk group to reoffend. Medium risk really are right in between high and low. So it's, you know, it's not a, it doesn't tell you an absolute whether someone's going to reoffend or not, but it does help us know who to pay the most attention to, and that's primarily how we use it.
Representative Butler. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so is risk assessment of reoffense evaluated as a person moves through the system?
Sure.
In other words, if they enter at high risk, do they stay at high risk until they're released, or do they?
Chair Patrick, Representative Butler, we reassess them every 6 months while they're on active supervision, so they can move into lower risk as they get their alcohol and drug problem taken care of, and they're you know, meeting all the conditions of their supervision, that kind of thing.
They can also move to higher risk.
And they can also move to higher risk. Performance measures, we have measured in 0103 reducing recidivism, positive case closure rates, and rate of high-risk offenders that go on abscond status. Probably the measure most people care about is the reduction of recidivism. Over the last 4 years of data, our probation recidivism rate's been fairly flat. It's not going up. It's not going down. The post-prison rate has been trending down during that period.
I have a question back on your high risk, low risk, mm-hmm. low risk. We see trends up and down depending on offender group, and I assume we do. We have that data available by county.
Representative Patridge, I know that we have that data available. I don't have it with me today.
I'd be interested on a county by county basis to see who's got more people moving from low to high or high to low. In terms of the effectiveness of their community corrections programs, you know that we've been working with Representative Williams and Senator Menes on some validated kinds of tools. So.
Mr. Chair, we can get information for you along those lines.
Thanks. So if we could just have a county-by-county breakdown mm-hmm. as to how many people they move from high to low when they have them in their system and mm-hmm. low to high, or, you know, who's going up and who's going down, and what it shows, and maybe if you could let us know at the end. If I don't know if you guys look, do you look at it that way?
Representative Patridge, we have not looked at those kind of trends. We did look at changes in risk as a way of measuring performance in our system generally, and what the research folks tell me is that's very hard data to use because the really bad folks drop out, and so we don't have risk. The risk scores always go down over time because the worst people drop out, and we don't have reassessment scores for them after 6 months, 12 months. They drop out of the population. So it could be difficult to draw some meaning from that. I think it's always going to look good, in other words. You're always going to see some effectiveness.
Let's look at the data and maybe we'll
Mr. Chair, the reason they drop out is they're going into prison. Is that
they're graduating.
Graduating where?
Graduating and going into prison.
Oh, okay.
Or not showing up.
Okay.
They're either absconded or graduating to
the highest
institutions
risk.
Of higher learning.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure that what a dropout meant under risk assessment. Wait a minute. They become your high school teachers or something like that.
The next section in the book is base budget, and the budget analyst, I think, has covered or will cover those sections. So we are now to budget notes, and Community Corrections had 4 related budget notes. We were asked to evaluate the effectiveness of alternative community-based sanctions, to develop additional performance measures related to what we learned in that evaluation, and to review the allocation formula looking for possible incentives to those counties that exceeded performance measures, and to provide a report to the emergency board last fall, which we did. In working through these budget notes, we worked with our Community Corrections Commission, which is an advisory group to the Department of Corrections, and it includes community corrections directors, county sheriffs, county commissioners, the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, the Criminal Justice Commission, and a representative from a crime victims group. And they essentially acted as the steering committee for the study, helped us analyze the data, develop meaning from the data, and come up with some recommendations. I wanted to share a little bit more with you about that study. You got a copy of it, I think, earlier in the week. Okay. You just got a copy of it. We, in doing this study, looked both at the national research literature and on the effectiveness of community sanctions, and we studied Oregon. We looked at Oregon sanction data looking at 3 different types of recidivism. We looked at reconviction of a felony, which is our traditional measure. We looked at arrest, rearrest, and we looked at resanctioning. In other words, another violation occurred, and that person was sanctioned after their first sanction. We looked at offenders who had were receiving their very first sanction in a 2-year period starting January 1999 through December of 2001. And we used data from the Corrections Information System and from the Law Enforcement Data System. And this is what we found. For all crime types and for all risk levels, the reconviction rate is higher following a jail sanction than a community sanction. So whichever way we split up our population, we found the same kind of result. All community sanctions have lower rates of reconviction than do jail sanctions, and work or community service has the lowest rates of reconviction for high and medium risk offenders, and that was 10% in the first year. We also looked at length of stay in jail to see if that was related to reconviction, and what we found was that high risk offenders have similar rates of reconviction no matter how long they spend in jail. For medium-risk offenders, the longer the jail stay, the higher the recidivism. And for all crime types, the longer the jail stay, it was associated with higher rates of recidivism. We also looked, as I said, at rearrest rates and re-sanctioning or compliance rates. We did not find any difference between jail and community sanctions in compelling future compliance. We found that in the year following their first sanction, for high and medium risk offenders, 34% of them were re-sanctioned. So we took a group of 100% of them were sanctioned, and within a year, a third of them violated conditions again. Again, no difference between jail and other community sanctions in reducing arrest rates. The average rate of rearrest for any reason in our study group was 26% for high and medium risk. That's not just for new crimes, that's also for violations. But, of course, offenders are not randomly assigned to sanctions. So there is some professional judgment going on, either in the case of a judge who's imposing the sanction or the probation parole officer who's using an administrative sanction. So we recognize that that's the case. And high and medium risk offenders, who we would see as being probably the ones we need to pay the most attention to, they were about 8% more likely to end up in jail as opposed to another kind of sanction. However, in the study group, most of the offenders were sent to jail as their sanction. So even the low limited risk offenders, 76% of them received a jail sanction. We do know that some counties do use a variety of sanctions and other counties don't. Some counties have a variety of sanctions available to them and other counties don't. Looking at the choice of jail sanctions for local control offenders as a group, which is a smaller group than our study group, the choice of jail ranges from 50% to 100% depending on the county. So we can draw a couple of conclusions from that. The choice of the sanction probably is a result of several factors. One is they do reflect county practices, which differ from county to county. They do reflect the resources that are available or not available, and they also reflect the professional decision-making of the person imposing the sanction. We looked at the national data, and it was consistent with what we were finding in Oregon. The national data tells us that if we really want to make a difference in recidivism, that treatment and rehabilitation are much more likely to do that than surveillance and enforcement. Studies show that adding treatment to a community sanction reduces recidivism by 10%. In terms of using alternative sanctions, both the Oregon study and national studies show the same thing, which is that alternative sanctions result in at least no worse recidivism than jail. Length of jail stay, what we found in Oregon was also consistent with the national research. Brief periods of incarceration are as effective at curbing new violations as longer stays. So there doesn't seem to be a bigger bang for the buck with a longer stay. And also in specifically related to community service work crews, since that seemed to have the lowest rates of recidivism, national studies also found no difference in recidivism between community service and jail. That was the one that we did find a difference that had the best reconviction rates. I do want
to... Don't some of those work crews and things, though, those are a lot of those are really self-selected. They're selected by base of... you know, if you're a multiple offender, you don't get to go be on the work crew anymore. So does that skew... I mean, I understand that they're also selected, so I don't know how much we can rely on that kind of data.
Representative Patridge, you're exactly right. There is a selection process that goes along with who goes where.
What's appropriate, what the appropriate sanction is.
And that certainly is a factor in the success of different kinds of community alternatives, is who you put in them.
Well, and I guess one of my large questions in looking at data and looking at all this is, we may provide treatment and all kinds of other things, but if we don't ultimately have the ability to pull the trigger on a ultimate sanctioned kind of jail bed, what does that do?
Representative Patridge, I did my next point I wanted to make is related to what you're saying, and that is that the local criminal justice system has more than one policy goal. Certainly reducing crime is one of the important things that the system ought to do. But we also provide at the local level a punishment is an important part of the criminal justice system. It's one of the reasons we have a criminal justice system. So whether or not punishment reduces recidivism, it's still a function that the system has. Incapacitation is also a function that the system has. And it's something that I think the public will continue to want, even if incapacitation in the long term doesn't reduce recidivism. And then rehabilitation is also a function of the criminal justice system locally. So our advisory group made a couple of conclusions from all of this. One is they thought that response to violations should include services aimed at changing behavior over the long term. In other words, we should pair sanctioning with some kind of long-term change. That we should include sanctions other than jail in order to be both effective and cost-effective. And related again to what you were saying, Representative Patridge, having jail capacity is important in improving compliance with the alternative sanctions that we might have available. So if you sentence someone to community service, but there is no backup, it would be pretty easy for that person to choose not to do community service. So then you don't have an effective sanction. Specifically, the committee recommended that we have and use a range of interventions, including but not limited to jail, that we make frequent use of community service work crews, we adjust jail stays for greater efficiency, and we pair treatment with sanctioning. The commission also looked at the issue of an additional performance measure, and we have added one additional performance measure to the 0305 intergovernmental agreement, and that measure is that we increase the use of community-based non-jail sanctions for first-time sanctions above the baseline in the study, which was 20%. So we're looking for an improvement over the baseline of the study. And finally, the Community Corrections Commission conducted a review of the allocation formula and concluded that the current allocation formula does incorporate an incentive for reducing the cost of sanctions through the use of capitation. each offender on the caseload is funded at an established and capitated rate, and so you are it is necessary in order to manage your resources that you are thoughtful about having a range and that you can't really afford to put all violators in the most expensive choice that you have available. So that was the conclusion of the commission, and I think covered the budget notes. I am happy to answer any questions that you might have.
We have counties who are doing it right and doing it wrong based upon the recidivism rate.
We do, Representative.
We have counties with higher recidivism rates.
Representative Patridge, we do have a variety of recidivism rates county to county. We provide that information to them every 6 months, and so we have a range of performance there.
And we have a list county to county of what their recidivism, by county, what their recidivism rates are, so we can take a look at what those are.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, is there an incentive that's built into the formula for counties who have lower recidivism rates versus those who don't?
Chair Patridge, there is no difference in funding attached to exemplary performance or not.
And has the group considered that? Was that ever considered or brought up as part of the discussion that was made?
Chair Patridge, incentives discussions usually work better when there is additional money.
Well, there was additional money the two previous sessions. So have they occurred at any point in time during?
Chair Patridge, this is my first 2 years here, and so I'm not sure if there were discussions along those lines in the past.
No?
I know that there have been discussions about that.
Can we talk a little bit about how this rate compares, how the blended rate compares with what it costs for the state system to do this same or similar job? This has kind of been a perennial issue, so we have to ask the question as to on a per day cost or what did you say average? When we had the forecast, it was average daily population basis.
The cost
for us to have these people under 1145 versus the cost to have them, there's a lot of talk about opting out by counties at this point in time. What's the cost, the static cost, I guess? I know that there's a dynamic cost, but what's the static cost of the state's cost of dealing with these 1145 people versus the local jurisdictions?
Chair Patrick, you're referring to the local control group that used to go to prison and now stay locally?
Correct.
The combined rate for that group is $64.37 per day, and that rate is derived from the famous 75-25 formula, in which 75% of the cost is driven by the average cost of a jail bed, which at this point is calculated to be $79.25, and the average cost of a community sanction, which is calculated to be $19.71. So when we figure 75% of the folks at $79.25 and 25% at $19.71, the combined rate is $64.37.
What's the cost to house these people per day in the institutions?
Sure. Chair, the rate, that the working rate is about just shy of $70, but that includes some costs that will be taken out, so it will fall slightly from that. I think it's 69, 94, 96.
We just have a one pager with the imputed cost versus the other cost, just so we have that. Does everyone on the committee understand where
that's the marginal cost per prison?
Correct.
Mr. Chair. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Butler had a question. If you've got a question, I'll look.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify. That's the marginal cost per prisoner to the corrections and the community corrections. Is that that's what you're referring to, isn't it, Doug?
Mr. Chair, I mean, the daily, the 69, 94, 96, I can't remember. 96, so it's just shy of $70, is the average cost per day right now in the governor's original budget. It does not include a little bit of admin. and it does not include capital construction or debt service. Now, if the state had to, for example, if a county or a number of counties opted out and they came back to the state, you know, one could use that as a basic measure, but then you also have capacity issues that you'd have to deal with. So the marginal cost actually may be a little higher given that.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, as I recall, under the 1145 agreement, the counties had to do a better job of enhancing the percentages of recidivism and enhancing OBSCON. Do we have any reports on that?
Ginger.
Representative Butler, Chairman Patridge, we do measure recidivism and the abscond rate. The recidivism rate for probation has been flat for neither increasing nor decreasing over the last 4 years. The parole post-prison recidivism rate has a downward trend during that four-year period. The high-risk abscond group, we had in the last reporting period a tick up. Up until that time, it had been dropping, so I'm not sure what happened in the last 6 months. Hopefully it's an anomaly, but it's about time for us to look at that again, get another report, and see if it's continuing to go up or if it was an unusual time period for some reason.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think getting these marginal rates would be beneficial, but wouldn't it be true that even though they are the marginal rates both for maybe a local facility and for a state facility, the actual cost depends upon which local facility and which state facility, because the costs of incarceration at the state facility probably varies at least somewhat given the size of the facilities and the management responsibilities of those. And the same thing could be quite true of county facilities also. So even though we get a marginal rate, it would depend upon where the space is available and how much we would actually have to pay for it, one versus the other.
Chair Patridge, Senator Devlin, that there certainly is a great deal of variability in local costs from county to county in the facilities that they operate.
I have an interesting question, just curiosity. The oldest facility we have, the penitentiary, and one of the newest facilities we have, the one in your district, what I call the mega facility.
Thank you. Ben, do you want to come up so you may need to answer this as opposed to
what's the comparative
Ginger?
Cost of those two facilities?
We'll charge that to Prison Industries, Ben.
Oh, sorry. I can fix that.
Oh, okay.
I thought we were getting new ones.
Yeah. No, we just get blamed in the press for it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I have here is a breakdown of all of the facilities. Maybe the easiest way to do this would be to copy it at some point and hand it out.
If you could do that, but if you have a rough number, Ben.
OSP is $69.20, and you asked about Snake River, and that's $72.
How about a little 60. Facility like Mill Creek?
Mill Creek. $53.89. And one of the reasons that you get a tremendous amount of variation is that, take OSP for example, it's got the old style cell blocks where they're stacked up number of tiers and there are a lot of people in there. Paradoxically, some of our older facilities are actually cheaper per square foot. We put a lot of people in them, and sometimes, as you've heard, we engage in practices that they're less efficient in other ways. So I'll copy this for you and hand it out to you. Is that it?
I'd also like to know what your square foot cost to operate, or your per population base to operate
okay.
The Lakeview facility that's proposed by the governor to be built will be. What's your projected cost?
Mr. Chair, cost per square foot
per inmate. Or not per, just per
inmate. Per inmate.
The same cost. So we're comparing apples to apples.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up.
Senator Devlin.
Those costs don't include any sort of underlying cost of the facility, do they, in terms of
I'd like to appreciate
it. Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, what Doug said was absolutely correct. The marginal cost, as Representative Butler referred to it, is $70. If you were to fully allocate it, including debt service and some of the other administrative costs, you would be approaching $90.
Representative Hanson.
It's similar cost in terms of the breakdown of cost per day. The $69 figure that we used as comparison for 1145 purposes, is that artificially low for that block of like 12-month inmates based on the fact that they're going through a disproportionately higher amount of intake? You've got the costs of stabilizing them, bringing them into the population compared to the population at whole that is probably staying longer times.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, I'm not sure I'm following you, but if I am, the daily rate that the prison system uses is sort of an amalgamation, and there are some sites where it's very expensive. Special housing units, for example, housing units for the mentally ill. Our intake center is one of our highest. Our second highest is a boot camp down in Coos Bay because it has specialized programming. And what we're doing is averaging. So you'll find different rates in different locations depending on the service and how long people are staying there.
So if counties offer down and that population returned to the state, they'd be spending disproportionate higher time in the intake centers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, I'm not sure that we've completely sorted out how we would do this. There's a lot of variation in the inmates who are being served locally, and right now we're just engaged in taking a look at Linn County to sort out. It's incredibly complicated. Everything from fleet vehicles to collective bargaining agreements, staffing, property. We haven't gotten to that level of detail yet, but we will have to in the next few weeks.
Mr. Chair, I have a hand and a Sherbrock copy that the department prepared for me on sort of when a county opts out, the types of issues that they have to consider. And there are significant labor issues, significant.
Are you going to distribute that?
And I'll make copies and have this distributed tomorrow.
Thanks. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, while we have Director DeHaan in the hot seat there, I'd like to just make certain we clarify the intended use of the Lakeview facility. I just shared with the chair that we're getting a lot of email, a lot of constituent mail, and even though Lake County is not part of my constituency, I've been receiving a lot of information from those folks. And I spoke to some of my former constituents in Lake County yesterday and the day before, and there's a lot of misinformation about what a minimum security is in those communities. And I need probably to have you clarify for the record that, number one, it is a minimum security, and number two, that doesn't mean that what we're going to be doing is that we would sentence folks to that minimum security and that they would be going out and working side by side with other minimum wage folks in the community.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'm unaware of any changes in the intended purposes for that facility. It is a minimum custody facility, work camp. Inmate crews will be going out to work in the woods. We have no plans to have our inmates work side by side with the civilian population. That's not done anywhere that I know of. They're going to be adequately supervised. Our practices have not changed in any way that I'm aware of.
I appreciate that clarification because I was in total shock that intelligent community people from that area would get the idea that somehow that was what that was intended to be. I'd further like to just, with the population forecast numbers that we've heard today, then just have your expression as to what, whether or not perhaps some of the Oregon Youth Authority facilities, which are mothballed right now, which are plenty adequate for the kinds of minimum security, the low-risk adult security folks that we've got, could be utilized if in fact, the governor's proposal with regard, for instance, the Eastern Oregon Burns facility doesn't hold with regard to the OIA repopulation. Can you give us some feel for
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it is true, and I think it was made clear to the committee this afternoon from Sue Porter's testimony that we're going to need the beds, no doubt about that. We're going to need the minimum custody beds. Now, you have a number of choices about where those could be. We certainly could use the OIA facilities. We've looked at those, and they are adequate for our purposes. Lakeview is a slightly better option for us because of economy of scale. It would be a purpose-built facility, larger numbers. So it would be a little more efficient than the OIA given those locations. And then, of course, the third alternative would be to rent a larger proportion of beds locally where there is unused capacity there. I think the governor has some strongly held beliefs about those priorities, and I think he's expressed them in the budget. But as far as the department goes, we'll support the governor's view, of course, but we could put minimum custody inmates in any of those three choices.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. We're out of time today. Unless there's further questions from the committee, we'll start in with the information technology portion tomorrow. Anything to add for the good of the committee?
I think so. I think when we come back to work session, there are a number of issues in community corrections that need review. Sort of the cost of opting out may not be able to get a dollar figure, but there are some real service issues which I'll pass this out tomorrow to deal with. And there is a hole in both the governor's and the co-chair's budget of right around $40 million between community corrections and on the prison forecast.
Why don't we ask, Ginger, if you can come back tomorrow just at the beginning, and maybe we can talk a little bit about how the projections work and how the and what the hole, the chair believes there's a hole, but what it looks like and how we arrive at whatever figure that may be for the benefit of the committee. Is that helpful to the committee? Okay. Then we'll start out that way tomorrow. Then we'll move into information technology.
Thank you. I don't know if finding a $40 million hole.
At this point in time, we're going to continue the public hearing on Senate Bill 5509 until Thursday, April 24th, and we're going to close the public hearing for today. And we're the committee's in recess.
Wouldn't we be better off if we were skating?